American folk here in Arizona received the biggest brunt of this disease, and so that points to issues in healthcare in not just Arizona but our country. And so we see the brunt of COVID-19 here in Arizona. It points to inequities in healthcare delivery to people of color. And we have to, for me, it's important that we state the truth, right? That we
have to leave it there. Mayor Romero, we thank you so much for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio and the Jazz Society of Oregon are thrilled to bring you the 40th annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, July 17th, 18th, and 19th, as a live streaming event. Tune in and you'll hear the area's finest jazz, blues, R&B, and Latin musicians over the course of 3 days. The Bayou Boys, Bobby Torres, Saida Wright, and Tezetta Band are just a few of the 15 bands performing this year. That's the 40th annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, streaming live and on KBOO, Portland's longest-running community event, July 17th, 18th, and 19th. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage. I've been in the right place, but it must have been the wrong
time. I'd have said the right thing. And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
On the KBOO Evening News, the Trump administration is requiring hospitals to bypass the CDC and send their COVID-19 data directly to the Department of Health and Human Services. President Trump again minimizes the Black Lives Matter movement, and leaked documents show the government and police knew that far-right extremists were the real threat at protests, not Antifa. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 15th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. By next spring, Portland's Wilson High School will have a new name, and other schools intend to follow suit. President Woodrow Wilson, the namesake of the high school, is credited for establishing segregation in federal government agencies and was a known white supremacist and ally to the Ku Klux Klan. Portland Public Schools Senior Advisor for Racial Equity and Social Justice, Danny Ledesma, told the school board yesterday, quote, "We're responding to the energy in our community about the name changes." Ledesma proposed a fast-tracking process instead of the renaming policy that was adopted in 2018, requiring extensive community meetings and input from alumni, and could take 3 to 5 years to make the change. School board members are also in support of renaming Madison High School, since the fourth U.S. president, James Madison, owned over 100 slaves and was the brains behind the Constitution's Three-Fifths Compromise, which counted 3 out of every 5 slaves in the South as people. Public sentiment would seem to agree, as a couple weeks ago, protesters brought down a statue of Thomas Jefferson that stood in front of Jefferson High School. Several other schools could also be renamed, including Jackson Middle School, named for President Andrew Jackson, who signed the Indian Removal Act, which relocated tens of thousands of Native Americans from their homes, murdering thousands of them in the process, as well as Lane Middle School, named for Joseph Lane, the Oregon Territory's first governor, who ran for president on a pro-slavery ticket against Abraham Lincoln. The Trump administration has ordered hospitals to send their COVID-19 data directly to the Department of Health and Human Services, and not to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Public health experts have quickly criticized the move, as the Department of Health and Human Services system is specifically designed to make the information inaccessible to the public. The HHS system is new, untested, and managed by Teletracking, which is a private health data firm, while the CDC has been collecting and distributing important health information for decades. The move could affect the work of many researchers and health officials who rely on CDC data to make crucial decisions and projections. Some fear the change gives the administration, which has long complained about testing numbers, the chance to further suppress important information relating to the coronavirus. Dr. Allison Galvani, a Yale epidemiologist, said in response to the news, quote, "The underreporting of COVID-19 is about to get a lot worse and much less transparent." An open letter signed by 20 advocacy groups, including Public Citizen, American Muslim Health Professionals, and Social Security Works, asked President Trump and Vice President Pence to, quote, "immediately step aside from any further role in leading or communicating about the federal response to the pandemic and hand full control over to medical experts." The White House has not yet responded. 12 billionaires in Washington state have added $90 billion to their wealth since the start of the pandemic. Meanwhile, the state predicts a $4.5 billion deficit in next year's budget. Eric Tegedoff of the Public News Service has more on the story.
During the pandemic, Washington's billionaires have made enough money to cover the state's 2021 budget shortfall with $85 billion to spare. According to a new analysis, Washington's 12 billionaires added nearly $90 billion to their wealth between mid-March and mid-June, the second highest amount in the country behind California. Meanwhile, the state predicts a $4.5 billion hole in next year's budget. Frank Clementi heads the group Americans for Tax Fairness, which co-wrote the report. He says the shortfall means slashing budgets for education, housing, and food and nutrition programs.
The inequities, the inequality that's happening in this era in America is astonishing, and it needs a remedy.
The report was co-authored by the Economic Opportunity Institute and Healthcare for America Now. Nationwide, it says billionaires' wealth increased $584 billion between mid-March and mid-June. During this period, 1.3 million Washingtonians lost their jobs. Executive Director of Healthcare for America Now, Margarita George, says that's bad news for their health insurance.
We will expect that a lot of those people are going to lose their employer-sponsored coverage. Even people who are laid off, their job isn't permanently terminated. During the time that they're laid off, if they're going to retain their healthcare, they're going to have to pay the full cost of it.
Clementi says the CARES Act, passed in March to provide coronavirus relief, included a tax break for the country's millionaires. He wants the Senate to approve the HEROES Act, which would repeal that tax break.
If we repeal that giveaway, we raise $250 billion. That's a quarter of a trillion dollars we would raise. That's money that could go directly into more services for folks at the community level, family level, pay for extended unemployment benefits, things like that.
Clementi hopes Congress can pass the HEROES Act before its next recess begins on August 7th. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The state of Washington is offering at-home caregivers a month-long supply of personal protective equipment. We go again to the Public News Service's Eric Tegedoff to learn more.
As COVID-19 cases increase, home care workers can get a 31-day supply of personal protective equipment from the state of Washington. B. Rector, who directs the Home and Community Services Division in the Aging and Long-Term Support Administration, says individual providers, or IPs, weren't originally prioritized as Tier 1 essential workers, and because of low supplies, she adds they were only able to provide PPE to providers working with people suspected of having COVID-19.
Through some additional federal funding that we received, we were able to order this large supply, an $8 million order for personal protective equipment for IPs, regardless of whether they're working for a COVID suspected or confirmed or not.
Home care workers can submit a request to the Department of Health and Human Services Developmental Disabilities Administration or their local area agency on aging. Rector says IPs are provided gowns, gloves, face shields, plus N95 masks in COVID-19 confirmed cases or surgical masks if their patient isn't suspected of having the virus. She adds the state is also helping to get some tasks done remotely via phone or computer.
Things like medication reminders or grocery shopping, picking up pharmaceuticals and things like that in order to reduce the amount of time people are face-to-face.
Rector says much of IP work has to be done face-to-face, but luckily the spread of the virus has been lower in homes compared to group care facilities. She notes that some providers are family members, meaning they can isolate themselves together.
The kinds of services that individual providers do are vital to helping people with disabilities and older adults be able to remain independent in their own homes.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
During a recent interview with CBS News correspondent Catherine Herridge, President Trump responded to a line of questioning about black deaths at the hands of police across the country by saying that white people are dying too. He continued by saying, quote, "What a terrible question to ask. More white people, by the way. Trump's response, though technically correct, ignores the fact that white people make up 60% of the population, while black Americans make up only 13%. A 2018 study published by the American Public Health Association showed that black men are 350% more likely to get killed by police than white men. Another study by Harvard showed black men are at least 300% more likely to be killed than white men. Trump also defended the Confederate flag, saying those who display it are merely choosing to exercise their freedom of speech. Herridge asked Trump if he understood that the flag is, quote, a painful symbol for many people because it's a reminder of slavery. Trump responded by stressing that many people love the Confederate flag and compared those people to supporters of the Black Lives Matter movement. In recent days, Trump has also called the Black Lives Matter mural in front of Trump Tower in New York City a symbol of hate. Yesterday was International Non-Binary Day, a day meant to expand dialogue and to celebrate the rich diversity of our communities. The term non-binary is an umbrella term used by people who prefer to be identified outside of the normalized and limited gender binary of female and male. Non-binary folks may choose to identify as having two genders, having no gender, fluctuating between genders, being third gendered, or any myriad of other ways of identifying themselves, including rejecting gender identities altogether. Gender identity is different than sexual orientation among people who identify as non-binary, just as it is different among cisgendered people. Cisgender refers to people who identify with the gender they were assigned at birth. The day was first celebrated in 2012 and is aimed at raising awareness and organizing around the issues faced by non-binary people around the world. The date was chosen because it falls exactly between International Men's Day and International Women's Day. Most countries around the world do not recognize non-binary as a legal gender, leaving people who identify as non-binary with a gendered license or passport. 18 U.S. states, including Oregon, allow individuals to mark their gender as X on their license. A new report from The Intercept shows the government knew that far-right extremists were a threat during the demonstrations following the murder of George Floyd. Here's KBOO's Nat Moon with more on the story.
Leaked documents have shown that police around the country knew far-right extremists were the real threat at protests, not Antifa. A report from The Intercept today says law enforcement offices across the country have been sharing detailed reports of, quote, far-right extremists seeking to attack the protesters and police during the country's historic demonstrations. Newly leaked documents that were recently obtained and posted online under the title Blue Leaks give a glimpse into the communications between local, state, and federal law enforcement during the protests over the past 7 weeks. The leaked documents show a steady stream of threats of white supremacist violence receiving, as Henna Shamsi, director of the ACLU's National Security Project, said, quote, the benefit of the doubt as potential lone offenders. That is in contrast to the depiction of Antifa that the Trump administration has leaned into, citing Antifa as an organized and secretly funded group. President Trump and Attorney General Barr have continuously spun the story that leftists known as Antifa are hijacking the protests and destroying property, even going so far as to label them domestic terrorists and threatening state violence against them. That includes sending federal agents to Portland protests. Antifa, of course, is not an organization, but a decentralized group of individuals who simply consider themselves to be anti-fascist. A white supremacist group called National Accelerationist Revival, with over 3,400 members and known to support violence, advocated in May for the use of firearms, Molotov cocktails, and chainsaws in order to break police lines. This group is part of a larger movement calling for the start of the, quote, boogaloo, a term used by violent extremists to refer to the start of a second civil war. The report shows that the government knew about the National Accelerationist Revival, among other far-right groups, and instead chose to fabricate a story about far-left extremists. Michael German, a former FBI agent specializing in domestic terrorism, said that the impulse to paint both sides of the political spectrum with the same brush, despite the fact that only the far-right is actively killing people, is among the most dangerous features of modern American law enforcement today. Reporting for KABU, I'm Nat Moon.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth look at the recent Portland Citizen Review Committee Forum on Police Brutality and Accountability. At 6, we'll hear Rural Roots Rising, at 6:30, Free Culture Radio, then at 7, Sojourner Truth. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 62 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, expect mostly sunny skies and a high of 85. Today in history, in 1942, Vivian Malone Jones was born. Jones was one of the first two black students to enroll at the University of Alabama in 1963. The governor of Alabama attempted to block her and James Hood from enrolling at the all-white school. In 1965, she was the university's first black graduate. The quote of the day is from Malcolm X, who said, quote, "If you stick a knife 9 inches into my back and pull it out 3 inches, that is not progress. Even if you pull it out all the way, that is not progress. Progress is healing the wound, and America hasn't even begun to pull out the knife." Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez gave a COVID-19 update during a virtual town hall in which he praised Navajo Nation citizens for their commitment to flattening the curve as surrounding communities have watched their numbers rise. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Last week, two pipelines hit major snags in federal courts. This week, their stories continue as courts in the District of Columbia and Montana consider new filings. Victoria Wicks has this update.
Last week, a District of Columbia judge ordered that the Dakota Access Pipeline, or DAPL, should be shut down and drained of oil because of insufficient environmental studies. The North Dakota pipeline has been in operation for 3 years. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers immediately appealed, and now the D.C. Federal Appeals Court has stayed that shutdown order. The appeals court noted it needs more time to consider the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers' request for a permanent stay. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and other DAPL opponents have until Monday to file a response. Also last week, the Keystone XL pipeline lost its bid in the U.S. Supreme Court to have its water crossing permits restored. That pipeline is still in the pre-construction stage. A Montana federal court earlier revoked those permits, again because of flawed environmental studies. Now five environmental groups have filed another lawsuit in Montana federal court, this time against the Bureau of Land Management, for permitting the Keystone XL pipeline to cross about 44 miles of BLM-controlled land without adequate environmental studies. The deadline for BLM's response has not yet been set. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
A plan from the U.S. Forest Service recognizes the cultural significance of an area in Montana. A Crow citizen says tribes want to see permanent protection of all sacred areas. Eric Tigetoff has more.
In the U.S. Forest Service's final draft of its Custer-Gallatin National Forest Plan released last week, the agency recognizes the cultural and spiritual significance of the Crazy Mountains, designating it an area of tribal interest. Shane Doyle, a Crow tribal member and founder of Native Nexus Consulting, says the Crazies, as they're known locally, are a ceremonial site.
We've been going fast there for many hundreds of years, since time immemorial, and it's always been a concern among the Crow people that at some point we might lose that opportunity.
The Custer-Gallatin plan recognizes only the southern part of the Crazies. Doyle adds that it's important to protect this place for the future.
It's part of our heritage, and we want to continue to be able to offer that opportunity to young people as the generations go by.
People and organizations that commented on the forest plans earlier in the process can still submit objections to the final plans. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez says the country is again watching the Navajo Nation in its fight against COVID-19. High numbers of positive cases in the spring drew much media attention, but Nez says this time people are watching how the tribe has been able to flatten the curve as surrounding communities are seeing a surge, including in Arizona. Data from Navajo health departments as of Tuesday show 47 new COVID-19 positive cases and no recent deaths. Nez credits Navajo citizens for following tribal emergency safety measures for months.
You know, four things we said early on: wear your mask, social distance, wash your hands, stay home. And the Navajo people took that in, and that is the reason why we have flattened the curve, and now you see a reduction in COVID positive cases here on the Navajo Nation.
Nez is urging Navajo citizens not to let up on COVID-19 precautions as safety orders are extended through July. Positive cases for the Navajo Nation are 8,290 with 401 deaths and more than 6,000 recoveries. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden has followed up on a climate plan from his task force, which is made up of his and Bernie Sanders' supporters. With more on the story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
We're going to achieve a carbon pollution-free electric sector by the year 2035.
Former Vice President Joe Biden announced a new plan to invest $2 trillion into clean energy, following up on new policy ideas from his task forces, made up of supporters of both Biden and former candidate Bernie Sanders.
Transforming the American electrical sector to produce power without producing carbon pollution and electrifying an increased share of our economy will be the greatest spurring of job creation and economic competitiveness in the 21st century.
Biden also launched his first Texas TV ad yesterday in a state which hasn't voted for a Democrat since 1976. Recent polls there show him even with President Donald Trump. Texas, Maine, and Alabama all had elections yesterday. In order to vote by mail, Texans were still required to be over 65, have a disability, or be physically out of their counties.
Texas has established itself as one of the most hostile states in the nation when it comes to acknowledging the impact of the pandemic on our election.
Kristen Clark from the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law says we need to make the necessary investments to ease the voting process.
This season makes clear that the formula for success is having open access to absentee balloting, having robust early voting opportunities for voters, and having meaningful and accessible, safe and secure in-person voting opportunities on Election Day.
Maine House Speaker Sarah Gideon will take on Senator Susan Collins in November. Three races tested the weight of Trump endorsements. The president backed a pair of Texas House candidates, and from Alabama, former Auburn football coach Tommy Tuberville. Tuberville swiftly defeated former Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who angered Trump when he recused himself from the Russia investigation. Here's Alabama State University professor Darren Moten's take.
Jeff Sessions seems to have been snake bit because of his relationship with President Trump.
The Associated Press obtained new data from California's March presidential primary. More than 100,000 ballots were rejected, about 1.5% of ballots returned, for technical errors or missing the deadline. For this fall, California's deadline is extended, so ballots can be received up to 17 days after Election Day. Plus, voters can sign up for an online ballot tracking tool to alert them if there's a signature missing or some other changes needed, though counties are not required to use it. Attorney Chirag Baines worked for the U.S. Justice Department and is now with nonprofit Demos. He says high rejection rates may be part of why some voters, particularly Black, Indigenous, and other people of color, prefer to go in person.
The rate at which ballots are rejected, mail ballots are received by the state, but the state determines that they don't count because there's an error or because they come in late or for another reason, some technical problem, is much higher. The rejection rate is much higher for Black and Brown voters.
And with COVID-19 cases rising in Florida, Republicans are reportedly planning to move their national convention in Jacksonville to an outdoor arena. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael worries we're being led in the wrong direction.
Who do the watchmen watch? Who do the protectors protect? Two of our city commissioners immediately ripped the feds for breaking the face of a protester across the street, while our mayor waited 4 days to ask the feds to please leave. Portland needs leadership against violence and greed, for equity in the planet. As the country needs leadership, not in spreading military violence across the nation, not in pushing more people to get back to work, back to schools, into infection, not in making America a pandemic pariah that no one wants to let into their countries. This isn't leadership, but sociopathic piracy. We may each have the right to do whatever we want, but we each have the responsibility to not harm others, even when our own lives are getting desperate. The few at the top want us at each other's throats, not theirs. As Benjamin Franklin wrote, we must all hang together, or most assuredly, we shall all hang separately. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
A new study has found a striking difference between which ethnicities are likely to wear a mask during the COVID-19 pandemic and which are not. Roz Brown of the Public News Service has more on the story.
A behavioral study of people during the COVID-19 pandemic shows not only a partisan divide about who will wear a mask, but also an ethnic divide. The study, which began at the start of the outbreak, tracked who would and wouldn't wear a mask to protect themselves and others from the coronavirus. Study co-author Gabriel Sanchez at the University of New Mexico says researchers initially thought men of color might decline to wear masks, fearful of drawing unwanted attention from police.
We actually found the opposite. Although men of color are much more likely to say they're worried about being essentially identified as a potential criminal by security police, they're still much more likely to wear a mask in public.
Sanchez says the study also shows people living in states governed by Democrats are significantly more likely to say they've changed their behaviors to help limit the spread of COVID-19, including practicing social distancing and changing travel plans. Asian Americans at 82% compared to 66% for whites said they'd worn masks. Sanchez speculates they attach less stigma to the issue because Asian countries have long used face coverings to protect themselves from the effects of air pollution.
Racial and ethnic minorities, and particularly Asian Americans, were the highest likelihood of wearing a mask in public, but all non-whites essentially were more likely to wear a mask than whites were.
Due to increased cases of COVID-19, New Mexico renewed some health orders last week, including a requirement for face coverings in public places enforceable by a $100 fine. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 15th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Roz Brown, Antonia Gonzalez, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 8 it's KBOO Talk Radio. At 9, Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, Fight the Empire, connecting history with current events. At 10, Flashpoints, investigative news with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11:30, we'll be hearing some special programming on Radiozine. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you would like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
On Monday, July 13th, the Portland Citizen Review Committee held a digital forum on police oversight and police reform. Relations between the Portland police and the public have become increasingly tense after over a month of protests against police brutality and racial injustice. The Citizen Review Committee, or CRC, was started in 2001 to help improve police accountability. The CRC is tasked with gathering community concerns about the police and making recommendations to the Independent Police Review. Over the course of recent protests and police reaction, many people have been injured by police munitions and by the use of tear gas. The protests and conflicts with the police there are really only part of the story. Portland Police has in the past had a poor record of brutality and wrongful death when dealing with people experiencing mental health crises, and it reached a settlement with the U.S. Department of Justice in 2017 related to that. Now we tune into a few excerpts of this Oversight and Reform Forum.
Hello everybody. My name is Vadim Mazursky, and I'm the Vice Chair of the Citizen Review Committee. My pronouns are he, him, and his. The death of George Floyd in Minneapolis has prompted renewed calls to address brutality and racial disparities in American policing. But the path for transformation has a long history. In 1967, President Johnson formed a commission to improve relations between the police bureau and Black communities. In 94, the acquittal of three officers who beat Rodney King resulted in Congress giving the Justice Department the authority to investigate police practices that violated civil rights protections. And since 2013, Black Lives Matter movement has made police violence a pressing national and local issue. Yet, as recent events demonstrate, we still have a long way to go. There have been calls to defund or abolish the police bureau, but what does that mean? And what is the best way to move forward to ensure equal treatment and safety for all? And so we have this evening a panel of experts, community leaders, organizers, and people with hands-on expertise to talk about how to change policing in America and in Portland specifically in the context of a broader concerns about systemic racism and inequality.
Yes, I'm Dr. Roy Haynes Jr. I'm the chairperson of the Bonner Minister Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, representing 25 different community organizations, and been on this work of police reform since 2003. Yeah, I think when you say the word defunding, it means a lot of things to different people. I do believe that there are certain areas that the police department does not need to be engaged in, and particularly in terms of mental crisis. I think there needs to be a professional people without guns that are able to initiate the scene on 911 calls. There are many models out there, even in our own state in Eugene, Oregon, where have performed tremendously on mental health crisis. I think on cases in terms of dealing with different areas of houseless intervention. Those kind of things are areas that I think could be dealt better by professional people with training. And when you get into the issue of dealing with mental illness, the officers are not adequately prepared to deal with that. And some of the many shootings, whether we're talking about Aaron Campbell, whether we're talking about know this, where we're talking about other Memphis shootings that have created an uproar in the community, have been on the issues of mental illness. I think we need to take that out of the hand of the police bureau and give it to the hands of professional people.
Hi, I'm Officer Daryl Turner. I'm a 29-year veteran of the Portland Police Bureau, and I'm the president of the Portland Police Association.
So a lot of people who were around in the early 2000s, if you remember, the state of Oregon basically defunded the mental health system. When they defunded the mental health system, it left it upon the police to be able to take that over. That was not something that we did by ourselves or unilaterally, but the state of Oregon defunded, if you want to use the word defunded, the mental health system. So with that said, the police bureau had to adapt policies and training to be able to deal with those issues the best way we possibly could. So when we did that, everybody left it in our hands to deal with those in mental health crisis. And the result of what we have now is the defunded mental health system that we deal with in the state of Oregon. And even though we're starting to get hundreds of thousands and even hundreds of millions of dollars dedicated back to it, there's about 15 years of catch up to do. And I am one that wholeheartedly believes, yes, we should have appropriate responses to a mental health crisis that don't involve law enforcement. But if we do defund the police, we also lose that ability for us to respond to the ones that we need to respond to. We have a behavioral health unit that is one of the top units in the country, and it's got national recognition, even from the New York Times, as being a trendsetter in dealing with mental health crisis of law enforcement agencies. That, with that said, I'm not saying that we are the professionals that should be dealing with all of those, but we have made huge strides in that area over the past decade and a half to be able to deal with those situations, as a lot of the resources that are not funded anymore are not able to respond at 2:30 in the morning, 3:30 in the morning, when there's nobody else out but the police to do that job.
That's interesting. Have you heard of what the discussions might be around if someone calls 911, how people would be routed to Portland Street Response versus maybe some of the providers in the area, maybe versus actual police in uniform? Reverend Haynes?
Yeah, I wanted to say in reference to the historicity of that is certainly very true, but what we have found out, and I've been dealing with each individual case since 2003, is that professional people are just automatically better people in dealing with mental crisis. And persons that are not in situations of carrying gun, even with the officers that are trained, in fact, some of them have advanced training, the immediate response in many instances on 9/11 calls is to run up on the scene and pull the gun first and then ask questions later. I think that kind of response is better handled by professional people. I worked in mental institutions while I was in college, and we were able to appropriate training handle people with knives and other things better than the police department with guns.
And Reverend Haynes, I'll be the first one to say that I wholeheartedly believe that the first response should not be the police. That's not the business we want to be in. But you referenced a case like Keith Notice, for example. His mother tried everything she possibly could to get the mental health system to give him the assistance he needed, and they were not able to do it. That's not an indictment on anybody working in this system. It was the system itself that failed with Keith Notice. And so that was a situation where his mother many times tried to get help for him and could not. And because he was over the age of 18, there was nothing that she could force them to do. And so
That's just one case of it. I get there's lots of cases where the police have responded and have not used weapons, have not used force, and have helped remedy some of those people in mental health crisis. But I do wholeheartedly agree that there needs to be a different response first before law enforcement is called in, only when there's weapons involved and there's someone who's not only endangering their own life, but the life of others.
Hi, my name is Sabina Ardes. I am currently the president of the Lentz Neighborhood Association, the co-chair of the East Portland Action Plan. I'm also the executive director of East Portland Collective, and I serve on Prosper Portland's Community Budget Advisory Committee. I live in Lentz, and I am the mom of a school-age child who is enrolled in Portland Public Schools, but my views tonight are my own. I don't speak on behalf of any organization. Just based on my experience doing work for those organizations, as well as being a community member, neighbor, an immigrant, and a mom. Well, you know, my experience with police is from trying to obtain a stalking protective order, attending protests, and then most recently being held at gunpoint in my neighborhood. Can you hear me okay? Sometimes my speaker's not working okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. And right now, I would say, you know, considering the backdrop for this conversation is that we're learning from the news, and some of us have also seen with our own eyes that right now our local police are collaborating with federal marshals to suppress freedom of speech and to attack protesters and deploy military-grade munitions on peaceful protesters for 47 straight days now. I personally find it hard to focus on what they're doing right. Donovan LaBella is fighting for their life in the hospital after they were shot at a protest Saturday night while they were holding a boombox. I have journalist friends like Beth Nakamura with The Oregonian, who's one of the people, one of the journalists who have held up their press IDs and got hit in the back with batons when they got, you know, swept with protesters, even though they identified themselves and they didn't try to be in the way in any way, shape, or form. So I do hear what, you know, the examples that other people have given, and I think sometimes it can be helpful on, hey, what are the things that we do want to see and that we are seeing? And it's important to acknowledge those. But I also think it's worth acknowledging these very serious issues that have brought us here tonight in the first place. I love that everyone has been mentioning street response. You know, a lot of us in Lentz have been excited about street response because that's where it was set to launch. My understanding from following the city council votes from last year is that with some of the cuts made to the police budget right now, there's going to be even more money for street response, which will make it more of a citywide program. You know, Commissioner Hardesty and her staff have come to our meetings in February to talk about it, as along with Kaya, the executive director of Street Roots, who have been at the forefront of promoting it. And it just it seems like a very promising idea. The way they want to involve the community, also, you know, in creating this change, I really appreciate it, and I'm excited about it. I like what you said, Vadim, about the budget being a moral document. We hear Commissioner Hardesty say that a lot. And as we talk about defunding, you know, the police, a more important aspect of that is actually investment, because that's how we define our priorities, by where we put our money, right? And if our priority is to serve the dignity of the individuals and communities while also decreasing recidivism and costs, then harm reduction, community investment, and increasing social services nets such as housing, public health, we're during a pandemic right now, education, you know, we're seeing cuts to education while the schools are closed due to a pandemic, and we don't know what the future will look like for our kids next year. Mental health, again, harm reduction services, but not just at the individual level, but public health policies based on meeting individuals where they are and improving their quality of life. Support for survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault support, gun violence, getting, you know, guns out of the hands of dangerous people who shouldn't have them, youth engagement programs. What are youth doing these days? Because they are not in school and they don't have a lot of places to go. Community centers are closed, you know, parks have just barely reopened. And I also think that we should dream big when we try to reimagine community public safety and where we put money. What about transportation support? You know, what if when you get pulled over, instead of getting a ticket, you get someone who says, "Hey, I noticed your tailgate isn't working. Can I help you change it?" Or your registration has expired. Can we do it right now? Do you have a credit card and we can renew your registration right now? And I also think, and with this I will wrap up, that we don't talk enough about community conflict resolution and mediation. This has been my experience, you know, doing work in the community. I know that people are more likely to call the police on each other or to pull a gun on each other than to talk to their neighbor. And if you ask them, well, have you talked to them? They don't feel comfortable. They might not have the skills or the experience or the education. And the city used to invest. They used to have Resolution Northwest available as a free service to community members. I think if they went through their neighborhood association, but they have defunded that as well. And I think that would be really helpful. And also investing in restorative justice, training folks in our community on what restorative justice looks like to help the communities that are struggling with conflict and keep folks out of jail and give them an opportunity to do better.
That was an excerpt of the Portland Citizen Review Committee's forum on police oversight and police reform. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO is responding to the COVID-19 pandemic in our community. Tune in and check our website for updates at kboo.fm/COVID-19. And don't forget to donate. Community radio is essential in times of crisis, and we depend on you to keep us going.
Radio's greatest application is in broadcasting mass entertainment. Probably one of the best ways to get started is to make it a hobby and build an amateur station. It will show you more quickly than anything else whether or not you can succeed in radio.
KBOO Portland.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around